The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org. In Peter Cole's anthology, Hebrew Writers on Writing, he includes S.Y. Agnon's 1966 Nobel Acceptance Speech. And Agnon begins, "Our rabbis of blessed memory said, 'It is forbidden for a person to enjoy the things of this world without first reciting a blessing over them.'" That includes things we eat, things we hear, things we see, which includes reading. So I would like to offer my blessings and gratitude to Trinity University Press for publishing this inspired and inspiring collection of anthologies, Writers on Writing, and for helping to make this special evening bringing four internationally renowned poets here possible. Barbara Ross, where are you? Right there is the director and herself a wonderful poet of Trinity University Press. So thank you very much for helping to make this happen. At this moment of change, truly, this transition, as we're forging new connections to so many places around the globe in this instant, think small village in Kenya, the faces of students in Egypt and Gaza and the Bronx this week, anthologies of essential writers from different countries are a great gift. Series editor for these anthologies is the acclaimed poet and critic Edward Hirsch, who will be moderating the conversation tonight about how local politics, national realities, and cultural traditions affect great literary traditions. Among his six books of poems are For the Sleepwalkers, which received the Levan Younger Poets Award from the Academy of American Poets and the Delmore Schwartz Memorial Award from New York University. Wild Gratitude, which won the National Books Critics Circle Award. We're going to have lots of awards in this introduction. And most recently, Lay Back the Darkness. His prose books include Poet's Choice, the national bestseller How to Read a Poem and Fall in Love with Poetry, and The Demon and the Angel, Searching for the Source of Artistic Inspiration. Hirsch is currently the president of the John Simon Guggenheim Memorial Foundation. The editor of the anthology Irish Writers on Writing is Yvan Boland, considered one of Ireland's finest contemporary poets. She has published 8 volumes of poetry, including Against a Love Poetry, In a Time of Violence, and An Origin Like Water. She is the Bella Mayberry and Louise Mayberry Knapp Professor in the Humanities in the Creative Writing Program at Stanford University. She's the winner of the Lannan Award in Poetry, and she lives in Dublin, Ireland, and Stanford, California. Adam Zagajewski, whom Susan Sontag cited as the preeminent poet of his generation in Poland, is the author of several books of poetry in English, including Mysticism for Beginners, Tremor, and Without End. He's also the author of a memoir, Another Beauty, and the prose collections Two Cities and Solitude and Solidarity. Among his many honors and awards are a fellowship from the Berliner Künstler Program, a Guggenheim Fellowship, and the Neustadt Literary Prize. He's a professor of literature at the University of Chicago, and he lives in the beautiful city of Krakow and in the beautiful city of Chicago, even more beautiful now. Poet and translator Peter Cole, a resident of Jerusalem, was named a MacArthur Foundation Fellow in 2007. His most recent book of poems is Things on Which I've Stumbled. His many volumes of translations include The Dream of the Poem, Hebrew Poetry from Muslim and Christian Spain, 1950-1492, Jacques by Aharon Shabtai, and So What? New and Selected Poems by Taha Muhammad Ali. He's the recipient of the Penn Translation Award for Poetry and fellowships from the NEA, the NEH, and the John Simon Guggenheim Memorial Foundation. Yvan Boland terms Irish literature a living web of influences and inheritances, of injuries done, of continuous fierce disagreements. Adam Zagajewski, in his anthology, speaks of the communality of Polish letters, the tribe of artists who confronted each other over time, shaping each other's ideas accordingly. And Peter Cole, in his anthology, lets his 50-odd authors speak to about each other. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our distinguished guests and let us join the conversation about the writer's world from Dublin to Krakow to Jerusalem and beyond. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. Oh, it's going to be like a call and response. I'm just seeing who I know. I'm Edward Hirsch. Hi, everybody. That's Ivan Bolin, Adam Zagajewski, Peter Cole. Thrilled to be here with my friends, fellow poets. The series, The Writer's World, is an idea to bring together various thoughts about what literature is, about writing, from different countries. And the idea is that literature is a kind of conversation within a country that you can't entirely know outside that country. And you can't exactly know even what the world is that you're looking at in translation. And that we decided that it would be, well, during what I'm happy to now call the Bush years, which are now about to be over, thank heavens. America had become a much more insular place, and it seemed to us important that, since we believe that writers have so much to say about a culture, it seemed to us that since literature is itself an international activity, there's no culture without it. We decided to try and widen the world and bring it together to see what writers had to say, and we have these first books, which I'm thrilled to report. And I just want to tell you there are a few others coming. We have in the works, the next books are going to be Brenda Wineapple, who has a terrific book about Emily Dickinson and Higginson out now, is going to do 19th century American writers on writing. Arthur Z has edited a book on Chinese writers on writing. Norman Mania has edited a book on Romanian writers on writing. And then down the line, Jay Perini is doing Italian writers on writing. The translator Christopher Moore is doing Spanish writers on writing. Malena Marling is doing Swedish writers on writing. The editor of the Washington Post Book World, Maria Rana, is doing Peruvian writers on writing. And Sinan Antun is doing Arabic writers on writing. So those are the books we have in the pipeline right now. So I thought we'd begin by, I've asked each of the writers here to read something from their anthologies to just hear what the literature sounds like a little bit. So, Ivan, would you start?
Yeah, this is a very brief passage, but a very key passage in Irish writing as far as I was concerned when I put the book together. It's by a little-known sort of Irish advocate born in 1878 called Daniel Corkery. He wrote a book called The Hidden Ireland in which he's trying to sum up these 18th century Irish language poets who really sort of came to desperation and destitution and their language failed. And he doesn't quite know how to argue for them, but this really wonderful passage expresses his anger and his feeling for them. Nowadays, to know that a piece of artwork is academic is to know that it remains unvisited and unloved by the people. The work of the Irish poets was academic, yet, strange fact, much of it almost 200 years after its creation has been found alive on the lips of fishermen and ditchers. In reading those poets, then, we are to keep in mind first, that the nature of the poetry depends on the district in which it was written. If in Munster, it is literary in its nature. If in Ulster or Connacht, it has the simple directness of folk song. Then we must also remember that the poets were simple men, living as peasants in rural surroundings, and some of them probably never saw a city. Not only this, but they were all poor men, often very sore troubled, where and how to find shelter and clothing and food at the end of a day's tramping. Their native culture is ancient, harking back to pre-Renaissance standards, but there is no inflow of books from outside to impregnate it with new thoughts. Their language is dying. Around them is the drip, drip of callous decay. Famine overtakes famine, or the people are cleared from the land to make room for bullocks. The rocks and hidden mountain clefts are the only altars left to them, and teaching is a felony. Not to excuse, but to explain them are these facts mentioned. For their poetry, though doubtless the poorest chapter in the book of Irish literature, is in itself no poor thing that needs excuse. It is, contrariwise, a rich thing, a marvelous inheritance, bright with music, flushed with colour, and deep with human feeling. And to see it against the dark world that threw it up is to be astonished, if not dazzled.
I'm going to read a short piece by a man named Gershon Schoffman. I don't know that it necessarily represents the works in this book in any kind of overarching way, but it does represent the anthology in that most of the people in this anthology are writers that certainly American readers will never have heard of before. But they're also writers who in some ways don't, Yvonne mentioned the sort of academic perspective, but don't really make it into the canonical version of Hebrew literature as it's taught today. I've lived in Jerusalem for over 25 years, and I don't think I ever heard this man's name mentioned to me by anyone in the context of a writer I should read, or even apart from the fact that once in a while he'll show up in a sort of history of Hebrew literature. So one of the things I did when I was putting this this book together is simply look behind the spines of all those books on the shelf that are unread. So in a sense, it really follows up on what was just said. Schoffman was born in 1880 in Belorussia. He joined the Russian army in 1902. He escaped in 1904 and fled to Galicia, Poland. In fact, Eddie and I were joking that a lot of the first half of my book really could be an extension of Adam's Polish writers on writing. Most of these writers spent some important time in Poland. One of the other writers in the book, who also spent time in Warsaw, Jakob Fichman, said about Schoffman's essays, and he wrote these modernist epigrammatic essays. He said that in their utter lucidity, ruthless accuracy, and compression, his sentences resemble scientific definitions. They also, maybe in exactly the same way, resemble poetry. So I'll read you. I should just also say that after 10 years in Poland, he then moved to Vienna, and then he moved to an Austrian village, lived in the Austrian countryside for a long time, and at the age of 58, moved to Palestine in 1938. So this is a short essay. Most of his essays, as I said, are very short. Some of them are even just a couple of sentences long. This one is called A New Word, and it has an epigraph by Dostoevsky, "The thing people most fear is a new word of their own." And all the writers in the audience will recognize this situation as they recognize that. The writer had sensed it even as the lines were being formed. This word was likely to make things difficult for him. He felt it vaguely. And only now, late at night, the night before his article was due out in the morning paper, did it occur to him, "What have I done?" There was in this word something obstinate, something that crossed the line of what was acceptable. This rebellious word was likely to annoy his readership. How did he let it get away? What could he do? Why was he always, always catching his awful slips of the pen after the fact, when it was too late to do anything about them? Tonight, he already knew he would get no sleep. But maybe, just maybe, it might still be possible to do something about it. He dressed and ran to the printers. It was midnight, maybe. He went in and gazed at the manager as though at someone who held life and death in his hands. He turned to him like a supplicant. Would it still be possible to substitute one word for another? No. The page is already set. It's impossible. Isn't there some way that the only thing I can do for you is to scratch out the word? It was done. And the writer, calmer now, went home and slept soundly. Coward. For once in your life, you set down a new word, a word of your own, and now you've erased it.
I'll read a poem, but not by myself, by my famous compatriot, Wisława Szymborska. The idea I had when editing this volume was to have all kinds of genres. So not, I tried to do to make it as little academic as possible. So I have fragments of letters, of diaries, a few poems. So this is the poem "The Joy of Writing" by Wisława Szymborska, translated by Claire Kavanagh and Stanisław Barańczak. The joy of writing. Why does this written doe bound through these written woods? For a drink of written water from a spring whose surface will xerox her soft muzzle? Why does she lift her head? Does she hear something? Perched on four slim legs borrowed from the truth, she pricks up her ears beneath my fingertips. Silence. This word also rustles across the page and parts the boughs that have sprouted from the word woods. Lying in wait, set to pounce on blank page, are letters up to no good, clutches of clauses so subordinate they will never let her get away. Each drop of ink contains of a fair supply of hunters equipped with squinting eyes behind their sides, prepared to swarm the sloping pen at any moment, surround the doe and slowly aim their guns. They forget that what's here isn't life. Other laws, black on white, obtain. The twinkling of an eye will take as long as I say and will, if I wish, divide into tiny eternities, full of bullets stopped in mid-flight. Not a thing will ever happen unless I say so. Without my blessing, not a leaf will fall, not a blade of grass will bend beneath that little hoof's full stop. Is there then a world where I rule absolutely on fate, a time I bind with chains of signs, an existence become endless at my bidding? The joy of writing, the power of preserving, revenge of a mortal hand.
Each of these books is very different, and so I thought I'd ask each of the editors to say something about what they discovered in putting it together and what really characterizes their volume as a whole. So, Yvonne.
Well, I do think it's a really wonderful series and very unusual because it's got this brief to try to go into a literature and say, you know, how did these writers look on the actual act that they were engaged in. I can only speak about Irish writing. I mean, Barbara and Eddie gave a very sort of broad brief, but in fact, in Ireland, it's complicated by a number of factors. And probably for me, the first of those, and maybe the greatest of them, is that there were, in my mind and a lot of people's mind, two stories. I think the first of those stories is always the way a national literature presents itself in its time and migrates out of its own country and reaches other people and forms a kind of a narrative. The way that happened in Irish writing was that Yeats and Joyce really commended themselves to the rising literatures in English and indeed in Europe and in the United States. And those writers became known as Irish writers. But there was another story. And it's Corkery, whose little passionate, skewed piece of writing I read, who said when Yeats was writing, you know, look what they've done. Look at the harm they've done to Irish writing. And he said that about Yeats and later Gregory. Now we're going to have, a sort of homogeneous literature, but we will never have an indigenous literature. And the reason for that, and I'm going to read just a very brief poem and finish with it in a minute, which will show it to you. The reason for that is there are always two views of Ireland, and they are in all the idea of Irish literature. The first is that somewhere under the levels of colony, under all the terrible injuries that happened to Ireland, under all the oppressions, if you kept going down and going through, you would find the old, pure Ireland. You know, some golden place, fundamentally uninjured, that you could reach still and that you could find. The Irish writers in the English language felt we were... It was untrue. We were constructed by all the injury, all the fragmentation, all the dangers that had happened, all the impairments, that we were those things, and that by trying to evade them into some perfect world, we would lose what we had. I never felt that you should go in this book to one or the other. I felt I should try to somehow show the rich, heartbroken tension between the might have been of Irish writing, which could in a perfect world have happened in the Irish language and never did and never would have, and the great, great efforts of the Irish writers in the English language who said, look, if we can't do that, well, we can do this. And what this was they could take the language in which the Irish were humiliated, the language of the garrison, of the bailiff, of the eviction, of the court, of the injustice, and take that language, which was English, and make it tell the Irish story in literature. That would be their great revenge. That was Joyce's great idea, you know, the uncreated conscience of my race. But in this book, I wanted to show that there was a real feeling that we might have been something different, that there were turning points in our literature, in our history, in our language, where poets and writers hesitated for a moment and said, what if? I'm going to finish here with one little poem written, a beautiful poem, by an Irish poet who unfortunately died young, called Michael Hartnett. He's writing this poem, he's a contemporary poet, but he's writing this poem in the voice of a poet of the 18th century, who goes through all the bad weather of the winter to find other poets. And when he gets there, they don't care about him. They're all interested in the new language, the new king, and he really cannot believe that they are just going to let it all go. This is called A Visit to Croom, 1745. The thatch dripped soot, and the sun was silver because the sky, from ruts of mud to high blaze, was water. Whitewashed walls were silver, lime flakes opened like scissored pages, nesting moss and golds of straw and russet pools of soot. Windows, small as rat holes, shone like frost-filled hoofprints. The door was charted by the tracery of vermin. Five Gaelic faces stopped their talk, turned from the red of the fire into a cloud of rushlight fumes, and scraped their pewter mugs across the board and talked about the king. I had walked a long time in the mud to hear an avalanche of turf fall down. I had gone 14 miles in a straw-roped overcoat, passing for Irish all along the road, and now to hear a Gaelic court talk broken English of an English king, it was a long way to come for nothing.
Well, unlike Yvonne and Adam, Yvonne is an Irish poet, Adam is a Polish poet, I am not a Hebrew writer. And so when Eddie asked me to do this book, I thought he must be crazy. It would take me forever to find my way through this entire literature, which I did not grow up with. I went to Jerusalem in 1980-81, drawn by the promise, the allure of Hebrew literature. I thought it would be important for me to find out what Hebrew literature held for me as an American poet, as a Jewish poet, and quickly fell in love with Hebrew literature. And in all the time I've been there, I've noticed that the picture of Hebrew literature that's exported to the States and to England, and to some extent also really throughout Europe, really bore no relationship to the picture of Hebrew literature that was forming in my mind and the kind of literature that really meant so much to me. The literature that I was in love with really was something else altogether. So when Eddie asked me to do this, when I agreed, I thought to myself, the one thing I want to do in this book is to give American readers, English readers, a sense of what it is that drew me to that literature and made me fall in love with it and continue to be incredibly excited about it over nearly a course of three decades. So in a sense, the way I began to think of it was that there's this kind of official version of Hebrew literature out there. I imagined it as if Hebrew literature was out posing for its official group portrait. And while it was out there posing, I snuck into the offices and started to rummage around. What'd they leave on the desk? What was in their notebooks? What kind of letters were in the file cabinets? What was on the floor? What was in the waste paper basket? That was the angle at which I wanted to approach all this stuff. I wanted to surprise the literature. And that's the way I began to build the book up. Anything was actually tremendously liberating. Anything I read through, you know, the entire century, 20th century for the most part, anything that bored me in you know, if I was bored after two lines, I could just throw it out. I had that. I knew I could only put in one or two pieces by even the greatest writers. So the threshold was set very high. In some sense, it became easy. The introduction mentioned Agnon, Hebrew's only Nobel Prize winner. When S.Y. Agnon went to, he also made a kind of Hebrew Writers on Writing anthology, and I think it was in the 30s or 40s, but he was collecting classical Hebrew writers, or traditional rabbinic Jewish writers in the traditional religious sense, what they had to say about books and writing. And he wrote the following paragraph, which then became the epigraph for my book, and I think really says in a nutshell what it was that I wanted to do. And he goes back, of course, we also have this sense, I think, that that self-reflexiveness in the arts is a kind of modern idea, but of course it goes back, it runs through the history of all literatures, and it certainly runs through Hebrew back to the biblical period, and that's where Agnon begins. And he says, from quoting Ecclesiastes, "Of the making of books there is no end. And if there's no end to the making of books, all the more so with stories about them. For there is not a single book in the world, not even the smallest pamphlet, that doesn't have its story. How many adventures its author and the book itself underwent in its making. And if we try to account for it all, we are not able.
Now I'm looking around. We have here an Irish volume, a Hebrew volume, and a Polish volume. When you think about it, in the beginning of 20th century, there was no Ireland, there was no State of Israel, and there was no Poland. So we represent three states, of course not states, but literatures. But still, I think it's interesting. It's a little bit a coincidence. But what it meant for writers of these languages, of these countries, it was that they had to invent not just themselves. Like each writer in every country has to invent herself or himself to struggle against the soullessness of editors and and of critics. But in these countries that didn't exist yet, literature had to invent the country itself. There were the republics of non-existing states. And I'm sure that in all three languages, for the Hebrew writers, there was this new idea of Zionism, right?
I don't mention that in my book.
Uh-huh.
No, I'm joking.
there was the Irish Irish Renaissance movement, and the same in Poland. There was this feeling, writers felt that they felt like there are no ministers, we have no government, we have to be instead of, we have to represent something. At the same time, there were deeply private writers who had all kinds of problems and as writers in rich and free countries like in Great Britain or in France, and where writers really didn't have to replace anything. They just had to replace themselves as writers. So this idea of inventing literature anew in each decade of the century, I think it's true for all these three countries or languages. In Poland, there was the independence that came in 1918, pretty fragile, and many writers were telling themselves, now we don't need to take care of our homeland. Now we'll be speaking as Mr. Z and Madam B, just as individuals. But pretty soon the World War II came, and many of them became exiled. Some of them perished, like Bruno Schulz, this wonderful writer, who actually could have written in Hebrew, or he made a decision in which language to write. He finally decided to write in Polish. So he is a part of Polish literature. He's one of those who, as you know very well, perished during the World War II. Many others went to exile. Out of each catastrophe, there was a prophet. The prophet of exile was letters. They corresponded. They exchange views, they exchange their ideas. And some of these letters are highly interesting, and I put them into the anthology. This was my idea, to make it alive, to not to have an academic, boring compendium of official statements, but to have letters, diaries, to have these living voices which people who were insecure sometimes, who, as I said, invented their writing all the time. And, well, in this poem I read by Wisława Szymborska, she ends with this line, "Revenge of a mortal hand." Of course, we should not exaggerate with the notion of revenge, but isn't literature a revenge of the introverts? So you don't? I think it is. And also, literature is this incredible thing that turns our defeats into victories. A love poem is mostly a poem of defeat, but a great poem turns this love, this erotic defeat, into a victory. In a country having the history of Poland in the 20th century, there were so many defeats, but literature was able, in many cases, to turn these defeats into victories. And I try to keep record of these.
Could I say something? Virtually everything that you just said, Adam, in terms of the Polish literature, there is a precise analog for that in also in the Hebrew literature. In terms of defeat, one of the early writers, a Russian Hebrew writer, is answering a critic who writes to him and says, why haven't you responded to the pogroms that have taken place in certain Russian towns? The great poet Bialik, the first really great modern Hebrew poet, has already written two, powerful poems about this. You are silent. And he writes a letter in which he lays out his notion of writing as victory. Wherever you find a poem, you find I have been victorious. And he lays that out. And one of the other poets, also a Polish Hebrew poet, talks about all writing as a kind of settling of accounts. And then Schaffman, who I read you a little bit of also in terms of the letters, he says, the essence of all this writing is nothing but an exchange of letters between a few kindred spirits scattered across the face of the earth, most of whom don't know one another. And that's, he's talking about Hebrew writing at the beginning of the century. The one thing that is slightly different, and I want to comment on, is the notion of the place of the nation in Hebrew literature, which I think is different than it is for Irish or for Polish, simply because, I was joking about Zionism, but I wasn't joking. Part of that official picture of Hebrew literature that we get is a canon that's been formed by pretty much the Israeli academy and Israeli literary establishment. And it is very much a Zionist picture determined by Zionism, which is why a writer like Gershon Schoffman, who I began with, was left out of it, because he really was not that particularly that interested. My anthology opens with a writer named David Frischman. He's an incredibly beautiful, powerful writer. There's a beach named after him in Israel. Again, I've never heard anybody talk about this guy. It's because he had no real interest in the Zionist project. He wasn't against it. It just wasn't part of his world. European literature was his world. So that Hebrew, and these are questions that come up in this book, Hebrew really had a different predicament. One of the really burning debates early in the century was, first of all, what language should these writers be writing in? It wasn't self-evident that Hebrew would be their language, because Hebrew wasn't really a spoken language. Even if we were to think of Eastern Jews living in Iraq and around Baghdad or in any parts of the Arab world, there were, of course, Jewish writers there also. They were writing in Arabic. These writers were, their mother tongue for most of them was Yiddish or Russian, some cases Polish, some cases German. Hebrew wasn't a spoken language. There was something, you could say, artificial, but there was something willed about deciding to write in that language that often had nothing to do with the notion of a nation state. It had something to do with the notion of a Jewish expressivity, where sources of power would come from. So these were really the issues of the day for these writers, particularly early on. And even once the state was formed, you find one of the reasons we know the names the famous names of the Israeli novelists, Amos Oz, David Grossman, Aleph Beit Yehoshua, Yehuda Amichai, a wonderful poet, but are because they very much fit into that picture. Questions of politics that really departed from that. You know, these were the kind of things that I wanted to get into my book. Also, the notion of Arabic. There's a beautiful essay in here by a writer named Anton Shamas, some of you might know, who's a Palestinian Israeli who chose to write in Hebrew. Right? He's a Palestinian, he's an Arab, he writes in Hebrew. Now he lives in Michigan. He's been teaching there for a long time. Mm-hmm. Michigan has the largest Arab population outside the Middle East. And he writes a beautiful essay about the way in which Arabic literature and Hebrew literature came together in him and didn't. It's called The Meeting That Was, The Meeting That Wasn't, about the sort of tragedy of this sort of near miss, which it plays itself out also on the level of the state. So I just want to throw that in as a kind of qualification that Zionism is just one part of this narrative. There are really a whole host of other very interesting issues. One, for example, I said something about, you know, how should they write in Hebrew. There's an essay by a writer named Yonatan Ratosh, who he basically saw the opposition not between Yiddish and Hebrew, but between Jewish literature and Hebraic literature. He thought that Jewish literature, this is in the 40s now, that before the state was formed, was founded, he thought that Jewish literature was essentially a diasporic notion, and that if a writer is to write in Hebrew, that meant that he had to be writing of that place where he is, where Hebrew came from, which is to say the desert, Palestine, which is to say that his model should be Canaanite. And he formed a group which was first called the Young Hebrews and then became known as the Canaanites. And he wanted to throw out all of Jewish literature, even if it was in Hebrew, if it didn't somehow fit this notion of the emerging literature of the region of the place. So you have all these kind of maverick voices in there, and that's what makes it lively for me.
We don't use that word maverick
anymore. I know.
We can get it back now.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. I mean, one of the things that's really striking me about these volumes is that in order to understand a national literature, there's a kind of canon formation. And we discover there's a kind of story that is often put together by critics or the writers themselves, and there are certain great writers or geniuses who are part of that story, and we come to understand a national literature around that story. But these books are making clear that story often has a kind of authoritarian dimension, and that it makes other writers within the countries that we're talking about a little crazed because they get left out of that national story. And in fact, a conversation about literature within a country is much more complicated than the larger story that the literature tends to tell outside the country. And that these stories, maybe because they have to be simplified, leave out a lot. And that when we read these anthologies, we discover that there are all kinds of writers. Some of them are minor writers, some of them are less important writers, but all valuable writers who really have a lot to contribute, who just get left out of the story. And these books are sort of putting these writers back into the story. That strikes me really true about Ireland, because the Yeats Lady Gregory story is so powerful, and it's had such a strong impact over here, that within Ireland, there's this other story, and it seems like there are a lot of writers, Flann O'Brien, Kavanaugh, and many others, who were made crazy by the fictions of the Irish Renaissance.
I think that's true. I think often the stories that come over and are very compelling in another country are also the stories that are able to join the other country's literature. You know, there came to be a very easy dialogue between the modernism of Joyce and the lyricism of Yeats with some of the things that were happening in the United States and even in England. The other part of things, that was Kavanagh, Nagoplin, writers like that, those writers were in a completely different world with no ability to speak to the worlds of other countries. And the funny part of that is that I would put on their side Samuel Beckett. You know, if you look carefully at Beckett and you look at More Pricks Than Cakes, his first book, and Dante and the Lobster, Beckett was a deeply local writer. And in fact, when he was asked, you know, he liked that thought and he liked to keep going back and pushing back. And he was once asked whether he would write his own books in Irish. And he said, au contraire, you know, because he, in fact, wrote them in French. And, you know, I'm going to just end this by the fact that Samuel Beckett, who thought about these things a lot, told a story, which is often retold in Ireland. It's a joke. It's an Irish joke. And it's often retold in Ireland. It's not retold over here, but it's a very simple joke. And the joke is this, that all the nations of the world were asked to write a story about the camel, representing the camel's identity. And so, you know, I won't go through it all, but, you know, the French wrote about the camel's diet, and, you know, the British wrote about the camel in the desert, and I'm not quite sure what the Americans wrote, but the Irish wrote the camel and the fight for Irish freedom, you know. And so, you know, you have that huge, powerful, interior sense of those writers who are over there and can think of nothing else. That's what Eddie is saying. And also, interestingly, what Peter said, they are the goads of the story that gets abroad. So it's not as if those stories separate. They don't. They live together uncomfortably. Yeats and Joyce were spurred and angered by the accusations against them. And some of what they wrote are very clear responses to that. What you try to make clear in these books is how thorny that conversation is.
It seems that one of the subjects that's inevitable in the national literature has to do with exile. And it has to do with writers who stay at home, as it were, and then writers who are part of the national literature, but in all different places. And it seems to me that in Poland, Poland is so, in a way, disfigured by communism that there was the writer, there were the writers who stayed and under the yoke of communism, and then there were the writers like Miłosz, especially the greatest exemplar of writers in exile. And I wonder how the debate or the conversation took place between writers who were outside of Poland and writers who were inside of Poland during the communist era.
We have the same joke, but not about a camel, but an elephant. don't you have it in...
Or it must be, but...
In Jerusalem. But the exile, yes. And for Polish writers, we didn't have much of a debate in terms of a strong feeling on both sides accusing each other. I know that in some other countries, those who went abroad were accused by those who stayed. The famous case is the case of Germany, where even great writers like Thomas Mann were accused by those who stayed, and I think they were completely wrong, that he chose an easier fate. That you know, he was a successful writer. He lived actually not far from here in Pacific Palisades. And they said, well, we went through the horror of the Nazi Germany. But many of those who stayed actually contributed to the horror of Nazi Germany, being propaganda writers. So we didn't have this kind of a debate. Somehow the notion of exile was legitimate from the very beginning. There were many. The very interesting figure here was Zbigniew Herbert, who who was never an exile technically, formally, but he spent half of his adult life in the West and half in Poland. And I always had the impression he couldn't stand either. In Poland, he was just sick of communism and the repression and all this. And when he went to the West, he had some troubles with some radical leftist intellectuals who tried to convince him that he should be very happy going back to Poland. So he was this marvelous writer, marvelous poet who would shuttle between the two territories. He also wrote a beautiful poem, The Return of Mr. Cogito, where all these dilemmas of return or not to return were voiced. Another writer who lived between the two territories was Alexander Watt, who died in France, died in Paris, but had very strong connections to the Polish literary life inside Poland. And also when communism collapsed and many of these writers could return and the books could return to Poland, they were welcomed. This was a great day for many of these, for Czesław Miłosz, who returned physically, who chose to live in Krakow. And some other writers did this. Not everybody was lucky enough to live to this very moment. So we had many debates and many misunderstandings, but we were spared this one debate. The exile was never meant or understood as a misdemeanor. And when there were conferences, international conferences in the 60s, the 70s, etc., writers from Poland and writers from the West, the Polish writers from the exiles and the non-exiles, dined together and drank together and spoke and exchanged views without any problem. One word, this problem of Yeats, these great writers who impose their views, their... I think it exists in every literature. And there's a debate in Poland, but sometimes undertones in such a debate, I hear people who would say that Miłosz or Herbert silenced other poets. I think there's a danger in such a debate because these successful poets, they don't silence the other poets. They happen to be successful, they happen to be great poets, and they happen to be to have bigger audiences. But this is not a word about Ireland, this is just a word about my own tradition. I don't believe in silencing. I think there are many injustices in literature, but there are many injustices in life as well. So.
There's apropos exile, with Hebrew it's kind of reversed because the exile's at the beginning and then all the writers are moving toward a kind of, let's say, homecoming. But then you get the curious situation, where I don't know if this is an analog to the Irish and the Polish joke, but the very common joke in Israel is that the last one out of the country should turn off the lights at the airport. Because the situation is always so bad, it's this ongoing crisis.
I have to say that about Michigan when I lived in Michigan.
Bruce Springsteen has the song, I came for you, I came for you, but you did not sense my urgency. I came for you, I came for you, but your life was one long emergency. This is Israel. They still, every year, the parliament, the Knesset, passes its set of emergency laws. And it just, nobody notices. They just pass it every year. And it's been since 1948. Those laws are passed.
The emergency state. The same laws?
The same laws, yeah. Which it just, enables them to basically do what they want. And so the joke really is, turn the lights out at the airport. But the more serious thing is that, of course, many, many people in Israel come from somewhere else, and they all have different passports. And if they don't come from somewhere else, many of them would like to go somewhere else, where they'll make more money and where life will be much easier and they'll be less threatening and so forth. And so people often talk about, why do you stay here? And about 10 years ago, there was a literary life is conducted still in Israel in the weekend newspapers, not so much in small magazines, although it's going in that direction. But the weekend papers are still more European in that sense and very vital, and they'll have many translations of a single poem and lots of, they'll have multiple reviews of the same book, things like that, in one paper. And so one year before one of the big holidays, they usually have some kind of survey where they'll ask intellectuals or leading writers about what they think about a certain topic. And one year they asked, I think this must have been after, yes, this was right around when Benjamin Netanyahu first was in office, and I think the second intifada was about to start or was beginning to break out. And so the question that they asked all the writers was, why do you stay here? Which is not a question maybe in America we were at that point where we could ask. But people, that was a serious question, why do you stay here? And
asked that in October, but
right,
now we know.
Right. one of the poets I translate, a really marvelous poet, I think one of the great poets writing anywhere today, a man named Aaron Shabtai, didn't answer the survey. In the paper, he wrote a poem about it. Maybe I'll read that poem. It's a short poem called The Reason to Live Here. So it's about a kind of, anti-exile, refusal to go into exile.
Sorry, Peter, could you say his name?
His name is Aaron Shabtai, and this is from a book called J'accuse, which New Directions published a few years ago, mostly political poems. He didn't always write political poems, but at a certain point in his career felt that he simply had to. This country is turning into the private... I should also say that he is the preeminent translator of Greek drama into Hebrew. He's translated the entire corpus of Greek literature, classical literature, into Hebrew. That comes in at the end of the poem. This country is turning into the private estate of 20 families. Look at its fattened political arm, at the thick neck of its bloated bureaucracy. These are the officers of Samaria. There's no need to consult the oracle. What the capitalist swine leaves behind, the nationalist hyena shreds with its teeth. When the governor of the Bank of Israel raises the interest rate by 0.5%, the rich are provided with backyard pools by the poor. The soldier at the outpost guards the usurer who'll put a lien on his home when he's laid off from the privatized factory and falls behind on his mortgage payments. The pure words I suckled from my mother's breasts, man, child, justice, mercy, and so on, are dispossessed before our eyes, imprisoned in ghettos, murdered at checkpoints. And yet, there's still good reason to stay on and live here, to hide the surviving words in the kitchen, in the basement, or the bathroom. The prophet Melampus saved twin orphan snakes from the hand of his slaves. They slithered toward his bed while he slept, then licked the oracles of his ears. When he woke with a fright, he found he could follow the speech of birds. So Hebrew delivered will lick the walls of our hearts.
Terrific poem. I have many more questions, but I thought I'd give you an opportunity, if you have any questions, invite you to ask any of us anything you'd like about anything in the world, as long as it relates to literature. Questions? Thoughts?
Yes, I'd like to ask all three of the poets whether the fact that all three of the nations and national poetic and literary traditions share a commonality with other languages. I mean, I know that's true of Poland because it was under partition, and there were many Poles who wrote in German, and many Poles who were forced to write in Russian. And it's true, of course, of Jewish and Hebrew writers who bring to bear to the Hebrew language languages from all across Europe and the Middle East. And it's, of course, true very much of Ireland because it has a dual language structure. Where do those other languages come in to the primary linguistic expression? You know, whether Gaelic, Irish Gaelic, comes in any significant way into the English writers of Ireland, and same true, of course, of Poland, whether German traditions, you know, come in into Polish literature, and whether, you know, foreign traditions, Arabic traditions, as well as European, pan-European traditions, especially Polish traditions, whether they come into Hebrew, since so many Jews.
The short answer is yes.
It's an interesting question in Ireland, and this book, I mean, the one on Irish writing is really salted with the articles and the protests and the elegies about the Irish language. The Irish language, although it was sponsored by the state, was not spoken by a high proportion of Irish people after 1950. The Irish Gaeltachts faltered these neighborhoods, largely because of the depopulation of the land towards the city, not because of the failure of the language. People who are Irish language scholars will tell you that the Irish language doesn't have a word for silicon chip, it doesn't have a word for carburetor, that it stopped at a certain point and couldn't find its path into a modern world. And I think that in some ways these dual languages you speak of can get stranded. And sometimes the elegy of the literature is about how that stranding, how they were stranded. And a lot of the protests here are about how they feel the Irish language should not have been stranded and how it might not have been. But the European community probably was one of the nails in the coffin.
In Poland, what the Irish did was impossible in Poland. I think I mentioned it before, not tonight. There's a letter by George Bernard Shaw, who wrote to the Polish writer Henryk Sienkiewicz in the beginning of the 20th century, and Shaw said, "I commiserate with Poland, with your drama, but as far as Polish literature goes, I don't know why don't you accept the Russian language? Why don't you write in Russian?" It was impossible because there was a struggle going on to preserve the Polish language. There were in the Russian partition, the Russian part of Poland before 1918, there were no Polish schools. Children had to learn everything in Russian, and there was a system of private schooling to remedy it. So psychologically, it was not possible to switch to the Russian language. So of course, all these people were bilingual, perfectly bilingual, and Jewish writers were trilingual or more. And the German partition, it was similar in the Austrian part because we were blessed with three partitions. So we had German language in two of them, and the Austrian one was the most liberal one. But then it produced rather the effect of the freedom of using Polish language in the Austrian part. Was not inviting, was not conducive to writing in German. There was, as far as I know, there was one Polish writer who wrote half of his work in German, Stanisław Przybyszewski, who had a certain success as a German writer, then he switched to Polish. Yeah, we still, but Yiddish was also a language. Many writers that are in your anthologies, Peter, wrote in Yiddish. Now something different happens in some, because as you know, there was this, Poland was like one of these movable houses that you see on the highways in the US, was brought to the West by several hundred miles. And we lost some cities in the East and we gained some cities in the West. We gained Wrocław, Gdańsk, etc. And so especially in Gdańsk, which was Danzig under the German, in the German times, and Danzig that produced Günter Grass in the modern time, there are writers there who write in Polish but have a very strong and emotional and positive relationship to the German past of the city. They study the German past of the cities. They are fascinated with Günter Grass and with some other German writers. So it's a very interesting case of what in Latin you call translatio studi, the transfer of studies of a culture. So not in terms of language, but in terms of a historic consciousness, of memories. That is, so I find it really fascinating that memory can transcend national boundaries, and that you can have writers who out of kind of magnanimity and out of not after anti-nationalism embark on this path to sort of enrich their imagination by the memory of this of the other path of the German past of the city.
Yeah, this notion of transfer or translation or movement of culture is exactly what we see in, for example, in medieval Hebrew poetry, which is often talked about as a branch of Arabic literature, right? The language, the kind of poetry that Hebrew writers writing in Muslim Spain produced really was a kind of, as much a kind of Arabic literature as it was a kind of Hebrew literature or Jewish literature. And the same thing applies to, this book is restricts itself to modern writers, but the same thing applies to the modern situation, in the sense that certainly the majority of writers, and certainly the writers in the first half of the anthology, all really belong to European literature. They are, for the most part, they get world literature through Polish, through reading in Polish or Russian or German. And they are, in a sense, transferring that historical cultural legacy into Hebrew, and trying to build a modern literature in a Hebrew that is not yet spoken. What's astonishing is how, again, in the sort of Zionist narrative, they look back and say, well, that was an artificial, unnatural Hebrew that wasn't a living language. But then when I went back and read deeply in it, I was actually astonished at just how expressive that literature is early on. What these people were writing in Poland at the turn of the century, it just, the clarity and the expressiveness, okay, so they didn't have the word for different things, but they were every bit as expressive and maybe more so than writers today. And all that comes from this openness to all the other languages and cultures around them. You also have things where some of the, you know, the more kind of idiosyncratic writers, there's one, this Avot Yesharun, who's also Ukrainian-born, then grew up in Poland, and then moved to Palestine, who simply, he's a kind of literary pack rat. He just takes all the different languages he has, and he also acquires Arabic. He works in Palestine as a manual laborer for a long time, so he has Yiddish, Polish, Arabic, a kind of Hebrew that Hebrew had never, ever seen before and hasn't really seen since. And he just sort of throws all the, not only the vocabulary, but the syntaxes, he throws them all together and creates this really wonderful thing. So it really is very much that kind of meeting of the languages and being informed by all these rivers and tributaries is central to the literature. Unfortunately, you have very little bit in the modern literature with Arabic, of being informed by Arabic. The anthology does close with two Sephardic Jewish writers. One is an Iraqi, a woman from an Iraqi Jewish family, who is deeply informed by Arab culture in a broader sense. And that, there is, I think, a real movement towards that in Hebrew writing today. And she, her name is Chaviva Padaya, I think, is the best of those writers.
It's interesting. In a way, Hebrew poetry in particular, but all of Hebrew literature, was thrown into the same situation that you described in his Gaelic literature in the 40s and the 50s. But it seems to me that Hebrew poets exploited having this biblical language and then having to invent a language for car, gun, the modern state, the language of the streets, that as Hebrew had to create a vernacular.
Right.
Out of a biblical language.
Yeah, and when there are several writers in this book, one of them is Gershom Scholem, the great scholar of Jewish mysticism, of Kabbalah, and another novelist, Shulamit Har-Evan, both write about the dangers of this, thinking that you can rather blithely take a charged sacramental language, like biblical Hebrew or rabbinic Hebrew, which is also very rich, and then just apply it to a secular situation without there being some kind of return of this religious repressed, which Scholem then sees in all the messianic movement, political movements that have really, you know, held Israel in a stranglehold since 67. So there are writers who are aware of this and understand that it's not just the miracle of the rebirth, but that there are serious demonic forces at work that have to be paid attention to.
I'm waiting for a volume in the series of the covering the modern Greek literature, because that's what happened to the Greek language is fascinating too. Greeks who practically gave us literature, then under the Turkish occupation, there was practically no written literature in Greece, and they had to completely reinvent the language in the middle 19th century. And they had a debate that went on for almost 100 years in which Greek to write was literature to be written. In the old, the language of Plato, or in the Hellenistic Koine, or in this Demotic language. And so these are some parallels to the Hebrew, to the situation of the Hebrew language here. And they decided on a kind of mix of all these levels.
Yeah, you see that in Cavafy, the mix between the Demotic and the ancient Greek. So other.
I just wanted to make a comment on the Irish language. And many, many years ago, I read a wonderful comment, and it said, "The Irish had a language taken away from them and another language imposed on them, but they learned to use it back like a sword." And I've heard many, many times when I've been in Ireland, the use of language, the English language, but it is used in an Irish way that is really like a shower of stars.
Oh, well, thank you. There is really an indigenous English spoken in Ireland, very informed by the language that is sort of under it, and very distinctive and different from the language spoken in England.
Thank you, hello. A fascinating discussion, and thank you, I learned a lot. But as a patriot from Krakow, I want to address one issue to Mr. Zagajewski. I spent 10 years in Krakow in communist government, and I was a part of a poetry group there. And what I am thinking just right now, that of course we didn't have any other choice than writing Polish, but in this Polish language that time, we have a very deep duality, because it was a communistic language, and our poetry language. And when I moved to America, then I kind of, I feel the freedom and new flow. I can talk about everything. I didn't have the meat, the motivation, the suffering, the anger, the fighting to keep writing. Then I found it after years. I remember you from Krakow. I want to ask you how you relate to my opinion.
What was the question?
The time of writing in Poland, communistic Poland, I want to come back to more modern times. How did you feel as a writer? Did you feel enough freedom in the Polish language to express yourself? Or because I remember we all write that we were writing like with coded language, Polish, but coding, right? So this language translated into, let's say, English might be not really very understood for next generation, which didn't experience our hell in communism.
Well, I wouldn't exaggerate. Poland was actually, in some respect, quite fortunate, because as practically the only country in the Soviet bloc, it had no normative aesthetic. All other countries, more or less, lived until the very end of communism under the domination of the so-called socialist realism. Poland, with all its communist vices and problems, at least in this realm, we had aesthetic freedom to a large extent, in the sense that all kinds of styles of experiment was accepted. I'm not an advocate of communism now. I'm just describing the situation. So it wasn't so black, so tragic. You could employ a rich Polish language. You could, if you were interested in a kind of surrealist aesthetic, you could do this. Still, of course, there was my own generation started under the sign of a revolt against the political situation. We wrote in Polish, and it's still readable, I think.
But you began really it does seem that one was your generation was defined by its opposition, and you began as a kind of, a kind of solidarity, oppositional poetry that was very politically engaged. And it seems to me your own development has been a little bit away from that, and that the situation helped determine that.
Well, very much so, yeah. But it was these first years in the 70s, this was a great adventure of defying the system. Soon it became a little narrow as an aesthetic costume to do this kind of critical poetry. And not just myself, several of my friends chose to enlarge their aesthetic, to do more than just to write this critical poetry. I would never. For me, it was an important stage, and you had to revolt against the government, and then you had to revolt against your own revolt.
And I think we've run out of time for questions. If you want to ask your last question of the poets, or however you would like to bring us to this conversation to its bedtime.
I wonder if you could just, if we have the time, if you could, since all of you were involved with American literature and American poetry in particular, I wonder if you could say if you could say something about, what do you think is different, or is there something different, radically different, about the conversation that's taking place to be an American poet versus, say, being an Irish poet or a Polish poet or an Israeli poet or poet writing in Hebrew? I wonder for us, for most of us who are American poets, how you see the difference, or is there a difference?
Yeah, I think I don't think it's the only influence on a poet, but the United States had a country where both the state and the nation came into existence together. I mean, it was brought to fruition at a time of self-definition, there is a huge difference in a country where the nation, where the state doesn't exist, it's somebody else's state, somebody else's army, but the nation exists in people's hearts all the time. Ireland was a country where the nation pre-existed the state for hundreds of years, and therefore the idea of a country as an imaginative construct, not defined by government and not defined by taxes and stamps, but something powerfully kept alive from person to person. That became a very dominant thing, which I think is very untranslatable to an American.
I came to the United States, to Houston, where I taught for many years, one semester a year. I came to Houston not from Krakow, but from Paris, where I lived then, and where I was quite lonely. I couldn't find a common language with French poets, and they couldn't find a common language with myself. And so for me, the discovery of the American world of poetry was a huge blessing. And actually, I saw more similarities than differences. I saw the same passionate debates about nature of poetry, about the nature of poetry and its relationship to the political life. So maybe I'm wrong, but I remember mostly, and I'm until now fascinated by the friendliness of the American poetry world. This is where I met Ed, my neighbor now, and meeting him has become one of the main poetic friendships in my life. And then I met C.K. Williams, other American poets. So I was always struck rather by similarities than by difference.
I love you too, Adam.
Often when American writers, or maybe not so much writers, but when Americans come visit me in Jerusalem, they'll be walking around, they'll say, what a great place for a writer to be. There's so many symbols here. As if that was an advantage, right? You know, wherever you look, there's a kind of throbbing symbol with a biblical and Quranic verse, you know, just under it for you. And so, you know, on the one hand, it's they couldn't be American poetry and the sort of situation of someone writing in America just couldn't be more different than that of a Hebrew writer, let alone an English language writer writing there, where really wherever, every time you bump into someone at the grocery store, it's just charged with meaning. I mean, every little thing just means and resonates in a way that things simply don't, I think, at least didn't for me in America. But they don't. Every little conversation really does matter in a way.
Unless you go to Whole Foods.
No Whole Foods in New Haven. But you know, the interesting thing, the equivalent of Whole Foods in Israel, who is the equivalent of Whole Foods in Israel? It's right-wing settlers who see organic food as a way of getting back in touch with the earth, which is, after all, theirs by divine right. You get the craziest kind of scrambling of codes and associations. I'm serious. So, you know, when we go to the market and you want to buy organic food, you have to read, if you're, I'm on the left and sort of politically conscious now, you have to read the label and say, is this, chances are it's, you're supporting the settlement industry by buying that food. It's crazy. But that's one of the craziness. I was with one of the Israeli poets in this anthology. He was reading at some American colleges, and I helped him sort of moderate a seminar with students. And the student said, why do you always write about politics so much? And he looked flabbergasted, and he said, that's like asking a Greek poet who lives on an island why he writes about the wind. It's just, you know, that's what's there. That's what the weather is. I personally have found Israeli poetry to be incredibly stimulating and dynamic. There is a sense in it, or has been. I think it's changing now, but there is that same sense of that I mentioned about rubbing up against someone in a grocery store or on a bus, that something is really at stake at all times, not just in the subject matter, but in the actual production of the literature. And that, unlike all the sort of symbology that's clinging all around, that I think is a very good place for a writer to be in that kind of force field. So that's something that I personally have gotten a great deal from.
Well, thank you all for joining us.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.